Good afternoon and welcome to today's Fireside Chat, focusing on the SEC Office of the Chief Accountant, broadcast by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Teresa Gabaldon, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law and moderator for the program. The SEC Historical Society preserves and shares the history of securities regulation through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times. The virtual museum and archive, as well as the Society, are separate from and independent of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no government funding. We thank the many institutions and individuals whose gifts and grants make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive to over 8,000 visitors each month. Today's program continues the SEC Historical Society's look at some of the major divisions and offices of the SEC as part of the Society's commemoration of the SEC's 75th anniversary this year. The SEC Office of the Chief Accountant is one of the original SEC offices, and today's chat will examine its work, staff, and impact over the last seven decades. I'm delighted to welcome Jack Albert, currently serving as Senior Associate Chief Accountant in the SEC Office of the Chief Accountant, and Gary Previtz, the DeWitt Professor of Management at Case Western Reserve University and former President of the American Accounting Association. Their remarks today are solely their own and are not representative of those of the SEC or of the Society. They cannot give legal or investment advice. Before we begin, I'd like to thank the Office of the Chief Accountant Committee, which has been assisting the Society for many years to ensure that information and materials relating to OCA and accounting regulation are added to the museum collections. This committee has been chaired by Linda Griggs and Scott Bayless, as well as co-chaired in the past by Gary. Jack has been a member as well, as have Jimmy Barge, Bob Colson, Terry Yannacone, Bob Kippers, and Mike Sutton. The committee has been instrumental in shaping today's program, and I'm grateful for all of its input and support. Jack and Gary, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Teresa. Pleasure to be here.
Jack, I understand that you have a significant amount of personal history with OCA. Could you take just a moment or two to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, certainly, Teresa. Thank you. And just to expand upon the standard caveat, not only am I not qualified to give legal or investment advice, but also I'm not really qualified to speak on behalf of the agency. I think those of you who are familiar with presentations by SEC speakers over the years will recognize the fact that these views are my own, do not reflect on the commission, and do not necessarily reflect the views of any of my colleagues on the staff of the commission. Just as a bit of a background, the Office of the Chief Accountant, of course, is part of a larger government agency, the Securities Exchange Commission. And as part of the as a government agency, what we do is we have a lot of meetings. In our office, we like to refer to these meetings as registrant meetings. They're very interesting meetings. They're certainly not perfunctory. And basically, the purpose of the meeting is to discuss the particular accounting treatment that has been followed by a SEC registrant with the concurrence of the registrant certifying accountants. One particular meeting stands out in my mind, and I still remember it to this day. It was a late afternoon meeting involving a Fortune 500 type company represented by a major accounting firm. The meeting started with the representative of the company kind of giving quite a detailed background of his history. It was kind of Chamber of Commerce-like, and the chief accountant at that time interrupted him and pointed out that he had something to do at the close of business that particular day, and so that he recommended that the person get to the cut to the chase, and so that they could resolve the matter by the close of business. The person was very apologetic and pointed out that the reason he did this was because his advisor at the time, a prominent accountant from Price Waterhouse, advised him to establish some credibility. So what I'm trying to do here is establish some credibility as to what I'm doing here this afternoon. Basically, I've been in the office of the chief accountant for an extensive period of time, starting in 1979 when Clarence Sampson was the chief accountant, through recently when Conrad Hewitt was presiding. In the interim, there have been six other chief accountants. Ed Coulson, Walter Schutz, Mike Sutton, Lynn Turner, Bob Herdman, and Don Nicolaisen. At the present time, the office is vacant, and the initial reaction was, that's great, you have a little break and you don't have a boss at the time. However, that's not the case for the various transitions. We've had acting chief accountants who are extremely capable. Presently, that position is being served by Jim Croker. Before him, among the acting chief accountants has been George Dicont, Scott Taub, Jackson Day, and others. So basically, this is my pitch for credibility, and certainly happy to be with you today.
Well, I don't think that either one of you needs to burnish your credibility, but I'm going to ask Gary to take a little bit of time as well to describe his familiarity with the office.
Well, that's great, Jack. That's a good way to get started. I think I'll do an academic twist here and say that probably since 1978, I've been writing materials and presenting materials that deal with the chief accountants. And just very quickly, I'll kind of give those citations just for the record. Beginning in August of 1978 in the Journal of Accountancy, there was a piece that covered the contributions of the first five chief accountants. In 1982 in the Journal of Accountancy in January, I did a profile on Carmen G. Blau, just a biographical itself, which is important in the sense it comes to the definition of what Blau meant by the term substantial authoritative support, which we'll get into, I'm sure, in our discussions. Also in July of 1984, when it was the 50th anniversary of the SEC, I co-authored a piece in the Journal of Accountancy in July of 84 on the 50 years of SEC's regulation of the accounting profession. And then more recently, I think in 2005, co-authored a piece called Keeping Watch, which deals with the last 25 years of the Office of Chief Accountant up through 2001. So I've been writing and researching in this area since 1978 at least, and that's a few of my credentials.
It sounds like we are going to hear from the authorities today. And I would ask one of your authorities to start us off by explaining the relationship of the Office of the Chief Accountant with the chief accountants in the other SEC divisions.
Well, I'd be happy to start with that, Teresa. The Office of the Chief Accountant is the principal advisor to the Commission on matters of accounting policy. And as a result, the Commission leans very heavily on the Chief Accountant. It's interesting, the SEC historically has been a lawyer-dominated agency. Over the 75 years, I think there's been one CPA that's been sitting on the Commission. As a consequence of that, the Chief Accountant and the Office of the Chief Accountant has a great deal of authority within the agency to speak and to help develop accounting policies. We don't do that in a vacuum, of course, and the other divisions within the agency all have very capable chief accountants on their own. So it's very much a collegial aspect to the process. The chief accountant of our office will coordinate with the chief accountant in the Division of Corporation Finance. We'll coordinate with the chief accountant within the Division of Investment Management. We'll coordinate with the chief accountant within the Division of Enforcement on enforcement-related matters. And we'll deal with the chief accountant within the Division of Trading and Markets, which was previously referred to as Market Regulation. However, in the area of when disputes do exist, it has generally been traditional for the Commission to look to the advice provided by the chief accountant. In many instances, that's not a necessary step, and in many instances, there will be discussions that involve various parties to the process, and it isn't a fait accompli that the view of the chief accountant will always carry the day. However, we do go in with the fact, with that particular advantage of the fact that the principal advisor to the Commission is the chief accountant on accounting matters.
Next, I'm going to ask for something that may be a little trickier, which is for one of you, or if it takes two, both of you, to explain the relationship of the office with the alphabet soup of, in no particular order, the IASB, FASB, PCAOB, and AICPA.
Well, let me start on that. In addition to being a typical agency that has a lot of meetings, we also refer to other organizations in acronyms and initialization. So that's kind of the standard group of organizations we deal with. Now, of course, the relationship with the FASB is a long-standing one. There's a memorable, notable accounting series release, Accounting Series Release 150, that was issued at the time that the FASB was established in the early 1970s. At that time, the SEC acknowledged or recognized the FASB as the preeminent standard setter in the private sector, and basically gave a lot of impetus to the work of the FASB, which was just starting in the early 1970s. Interestingly enough, with the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation, among other things, the Sarbanes-Oxley actually established rules as to, established law as to what would qualify as a private sector standard setter. The SEC looked at the infrastructure, voting arrangements, and operations of the FASB, and issued an accounting series release, Accounting Series Release 70, which essentially reinforced the position that had previously been expressed in ASR 150 to look to the FASB as the preeminent standard setter in the United States. Now, subsequent to that and concurrent with that, there were a lot of developments in the international area whereby the International Accounting Standards Board has been given prominence. As you're well aware, there's been a view towards eventually converging accounting standards because of the benefits that would accrue to the marketplace by having one set of accounting standards. That's the IASB. The SEC has a very broad project on ultimately possibly converging accounting standards. There's a so-called roadmap that identifies a host of issues that would need to be addressed before it could be possible that the International Accounting Standards Board would be recognized in the same fashion as the FASB is today for United States accounting standards. At the same time, the Sarbanes-Oxley established rules for what the FASB needed to do to qualify as an accounting standard. They also established the PCAOB for disciplining the and inspecting the work of the accounting profession, and that is done under SEC oversight.
Well, Gary, I think that he hit all of them except the AICPA. Would you like to introduce us to that entity as well?
Well, you have to go back pretty much to the origins of the Office of the Chief Accountant to begin to look at the relationship between what we'll call the accounting profession organized in the private sector and, of course, the beginning of the Office of the Chief Accountant. And setting forth whether or not accounting principles and standards were going to be developed in the public sector and government or they were going to continue to be made in the private sector was one of the key issues of the 1930s when the first chief accountant, Carmen Blau, took office. And the AICPA, of course, did exist in those days, but under the name American Institute of Accountants, it suffered itself a name change in the 1950s to become the AICPA. In any event, that organization represented the community of practitioners most likely to be involved with either the preparation and, most importantly, the auditing of publicly held company financial statements for public information. How the relationship has emerged over the years has been kind of a tennis match. That is to say, oftentimes the Office of the Chief Accountant would lead the development of issues or would contest issues that were brought forth from the private sector. And the basis for this was an early accounting series release. Jack has mentioned a couple more recent, statement number 70 and then accounting series release 150. But back in the origins of 1938, Carmen Blau essentially established a policy that said that the commission would look to the private sector and accept the decisions of the private sector roughly when there was something called substantial authoritative support. And it was never clear in the minds of many people what was meant by the term substantial authoritative support. One of the pieces of research that ended up revealing some meaning to that was when I mentioned, writing in January of 82 in the Journal of Accountancy. Under the Freedom of Information Act, one of the scholars, Bill Cooper, who was doing some work on Blau, discovered some correspondence between Blau and his successor, Bill Warrants, the second chief accountant, and gave a revelation as to the meaning of the term substantial authoritative support. That is to say, what would give the gravitas to an approach that would permit the commission to recognize it? And I'm quoting now from what Blau wrote to Warrants about what he believed the meaning of the term substantial authoritative support meant. He said, quote, "In my mind, it has meant authority of substantial weight rather than the predominance of authority. That is to say, it wasn't that 60% or 70% had to believe, but you could have several different sources. Thus," continuing the quote, "two contrary procedures might have substantial authoritative support, so that no matter which registrant, no matter which the registrant followed, adequate disclosure and footnotes in the accounting certificates or on the face of the statements as appropriate would be accepted without any changes being required in the body of the statements." Now that's 70 years ago, 1938. In the time, at the time, that was very helpful because it acknowledged that the private sector would have a role in developing acceptable approaches from the commission's point of view, and that the commission was not going to singularly and in a doctrinaire way establish accounting practices. Over time, as Jack pointed out, by the 1970s, the establishment of a standards board has taken the center stage in terms of what is an authoritative standard. But there's always been room in the history of the commission for a new or a contested standard to be argued upon, if you will, from the basis of substantial authoritative support. The early commission from the time of Carmen Blau on through Sandy Burton had indeed some difficult circumstances when there were differences of opinion, whether it was oil and gas accounting, or whether it was investment tax credit accounting, or whether it was simply the process of recognizing either the all-inclusive or the so-called current operating method. In all of those cases, the SEC generally went with a substantial authoritative support approach, that is to say, they allowed options rather than reducing to a single approach in the treatments of oil and gas or in the treatments of investment tax credit. In the case of current versus all-inclusive, the commission did come down very strongly in favor of an all-inclusive approach to net income determination, but later modified it. So I guess the bottom line here, Teresa, is that the commission and the private sector profession have continually been engaged in a partnership, and that partnership has sometimes been stronger on one side or the other, depending on the political environment and the market circumstances.
Have there been any instances in which the SEC has flatly overruled private sector standards?
Well, there's one classic, and it's been revisited recently with the SEC revisiting its rules for oil and gas disclosures, but in the late 1970s, the FASB issued Statement 19 that basically chose successful efforts accounting as the preferred method of accounting by oil and gas producers over the then alternative being followed of full cost accounting. The SEC, for its part, was directed by Congress under a particular act to do a cold study of the particular issue. The SEC looked at the matter. The SEC concluded that neither successful efforts nor full cost accounting was the most desirable. Both were flawed, and the basic rationale there was that both full cost and successful efforts are based on the historical cost of finding oil and gas reserves, and really the most relevant information in an oil and gas production is really the finding of the reserves themselves, and therefore the SEC suspended, overruled the FASB, resulting in the suspension of Statement 19, and embarked on a project to develop a new improved accounting system, which was known as Reserve Recognition Accounting, or RRA accounting. The goal of RRA accounting was to estimate the amount of reserves, proved reserves, that were in the ground, and to develop an accounting methodology that would basically revolve around the discovery of reserves in the ground and the estimated expenses of ultimately bringing them to the surface and selling them, et cetera. After years of experimentation, the SEC ultimately concluded that although this information was very relevant, it was not reliably determinable, and basically abandoned that RRA experiment to the effect that at the current time, companies can choose either full cost or successful efforts in accounting, and they do for oil and gas producers. So you find at the current time, although the major oil and gas producers fairly uniformly follow successful efforts, the medium-sized firms, the predominant number will still follow full cost accounting, and that alternative has existed for the past 30 years or so, from when the SEC originally overturned FASB 19. That's an example it's a rare example, but it's one wherein the SEC chose to overturn the determination of the FASB. I say the issue was revisited recently. The SEC recently revised its disclosures for oil and gas reserves, which are outside the financial statements, so it remains in place the ability to use either successful efforts or full cost.
Teresa, there are probably two other earlier episodes just for the historical information.
Mm-hmm.
One that goes back to the chief accountantship of Earl King, which was from April 47 to November 56, involving Accounting Research Bulletin 32. And again, the treatment where the Committee on Accounting Procedure under that bulletin number 32 had endorsed the current operating concept of income. At that point, when King had already indicated his preference for the all-inclusive approach, he sent a letter that was published in the Journal of Accountancy in January of 1948, saying that the commission has authorized the staff of the commission to take exception to financial statements which appear to be misleading, even though they reflect ARB 32. It was a very clear case of saying, we asked you to consider the all-inclusive approach. You didn't. You're on notice that we're going to be watching very carefully. The CAP attempted a compromise, issuing Accounting Research Bulletin 35, but that clash did not, it finally ended with the modified all-inclusive, but I think it was seen as the SEC's decision not to accept the so-called current operating approach. And then I think more classically, during Andy Barr's chief accountantship, which was November 56 to January 72, the issue of the investment tax credit in Accounting Principles Board Opinion Number 2, which in the Kennedy administration had been a very strong incentive with tax credits for increasing industrial investment. Early in the 60s, when this was occurring, the Accounting Principles Board suggested that the proper approach for the determination of the treatment of this be by the so-called I would call it a matching approach, a deferred approach, whereas practice permitted both approaches, that is to say, the so-called flow-through method, take it all up front or take it over time. And Blau, speaking at, 1964, said it's interesting that, the commission came down permitting both, even though the Accounting Principles Board, the then authoritative body, preferred the so-called deferred method. And it really was in keeping with allowing the practice units to follow substantial authoritative support in the sense that Blau had reckoned it back in 1938. So the APB kind of had to flip itself and allow the flow-through method which, you know, was not personally the favorite of even Blau himself. So oil and gas, I think, is more prominent because it's more recent, but there have been these episodes, and while, you know, you look for these examples of influence, I think of examples like SAB 99, Staff Accounting Bulletin 99, under Lynn Turner's chief accountantship, which ended just the start of this decade, where, you know, he really placed an emphasis on materiality, even though it wasn't an accounting series release or a financial accounting and reporting release. It was a staff position about the way in which materiality was to be evaluated. And in these many different ways, the Office of the Chief Accountant has clearly influenced practice.
Gary described standard setting, I think, as a public-private partnership, and my impression is that sometimes it's a partnership that involves a little bit of arm wrestling. But do you think that most people view the balance as about right? Either Gary or Jack.
Jack, you want to take a shot at that first, and I'll clean up what's left.
All right. Sounds good. Well, we try to have a balancing act because people would be surprised as to the constancy of contact, the frequency of contact between the staffs of the Chief Accountant's Office and the FASB. We are in communication almost daily. Now, part of it is a practical one. Much of the literature is FASB literature, and so as a starting point, we'd like to know exactly what the FASB was thinking when they passed a particular rule or a particular interpretation. We're not necessarily bound by that, but it's always a good starting point as to exactly what the FASB was thinking in their rules, because ultimately, as I mentioned earlier, we do have frequent contact with the registrants. And some in some of the areas where the rules are less than crystal clear, it's sometimes somewhat of a art to try to properly interpret the rules to see whether or not the company and its auditors are following the most appropriate accounting. So at a starting point, I think we do have a very collegial type of relationship with the respective staffs. The SEC will make suggestions as to where the FASB directs its limited resources. Like every other organization, the FASB does not have unlimited resources, so they have to pick and choose which particular areas they look to. And we do try to provide some guidance there. I think, you know, I mentioned the Sarbanes-Oxley having a big influence on what the SEC has done in the past 6-7 years, and I think one of the, as we're all aware, some of the major financial frauds that led to the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley included the WorldCom matter, it included the Enron matter, and the Enron in particular, there was abusive special purpose entities involved. I think we were instrumental in suggesting to the FASB that they improve the rules on special purpose entities as a consequence of the problems that we all saw from that process.
I guess, Teresa, a comment would be, depending on which point in time you were asking the question, you would get a different answer. I think there's always been a tension. Sometimes it would be considered healthy, sometimes destructive, depending on the emotions, the tenor of the leadership in the major accounting firms and at the Institute. But I think what conditions the answer is what the capital market was structured to be. Remember, if you go to the SEC website, and I think it's still prominently there, you know, the role that the commission plays in advocating for the investor is kind of a principal strategic purpose. If you go back to some of the data that existed half a century ago, almost 93% of corporate equity ownership was in the hands of individuals. Now, some of that was, you know, was William O. Douglas commenting on this situation at the end of the 30s. Douglas, who had been chairman of the SEC from 37 to 39, and then, of course, a long-serving chief justice at the Supreme Court, pointed out how dominant the individual investor was during this early period. Whereas if you look at it today, and particularly if you look at companies either in the Dow Jones, those 30 companies, or any of the Fortune 500, what you begin to see is the dominance of institutional investors receiving this information. And it changes the way in which and what you disclose based upon the audience being served by the disclosure. I use U.S. Steel as an example only because one of our doctoral students here is currently doing some work in that area. And Kevin's work has pretty much displayed that over time, the annual reports or periodic reports, as the commission might refer to them, have changed dramatically. U.S. Steel was a model of disclosure when it was formed in 1902 because it had so much individual investment, so much public attention. Today, I just got my 2008 U.S. Steel annual report the other day. It's a so-called wraparound. There's no annual report to speak of. It's 6 pages of glossy information wrapped around a 10K. This is a complete change from what it was in the early years, ever since we've had the so-called Integrated Disclosure Project in the early 80s, where the content of the financial information to the commission and to the annual report shareholder is identical. And so there's little incentive for individuals to create annual reports if essentially the institutional investors dominate and they essentially are satisfied by the 10K. And so, you know, there's been just a sea change over time, and I think it really occurs mostly in the early 70s to early 80s that we see this change from historical costs gradually to other forms of performance information, and of course now up to concerns about fair value across the board.
Well, just to pick up on Gary's theme with regard to the user, the paramount importance of the users, I think we continue to regard the agency as being an advocate for the investor, as in the William O. Douglas days. And I know one of the issues that all standard setters have is catering to the views of the users and trying to get input from the users. I know both the FASB and the SEC go out of their way to try to get input from the financial statement user, because that's ultimately who we're trying to serve in the financial reporting process. The private sector, for its part, has commissioned a number of groups to try to solicit the views of users. I remember the Jenkins Committee that was formed maybe 15 years ago before Ed Jenkins became an FASB chairman, that solicited all types of views of users to advise the standard setters and the SEC as to what the user needs are in a particular area. So it's not for lack of attention to the users, but the characteristic of the user, as Gary mentioned, has changed over time. That's clear.
Certainly, I have heard over the years that there is a public-private partnership as far as standard setting, as far as U.S. accountancy is concerned. One thing I've also heard, of course, is that in this country there is substantially more emphasis on rules as opposed to principles. Could one of you take us back in time and tell us a little bit about the genesis of that and whether it had anything to do with the Office of the Chief Accountant?
Well, I'll start out. I think Jack and I may have differing views on this. We haven't talked about it specifically, but I think the turning point from principles to standards occurs in the early 70s when, you know, the accounting profession is growing very rapidly. At the end of World War II, I think the AICPA, then the American Institute of Accountants, had something on the neighborhood of 9,500 members. Of course, today, its membership is in excess of 300,000. Not all of those individuals are corporate auditors, but many are preparers on publicly held company staffs. The point I'm trying to make is when you try to administer accounting in an economy as dynamic and as growing as ours, and you have that many people, you have to have some assurance that when you pick up a phone and talk to someone, whether in San Diego or Sioux City, that they have the same grounded fundamentals about what accounting is and does. So there's a huge educational mandate or impact implied in this over time. In about the 70s, when this growth was really occurring, there was a concern that was brought about, I think, that my own interpretation would be, as a result of the Continental Vending case, a case that began in 1962. It was a criminal case. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, which essentially began to question whether or not principals, were a sufficient protection for practitioners in a court of law. Now, that's a non-lawyer speaking, and I suspect if there are any lawyers listening, they're going to be tearing their hair out and saying, well, it's not quite that simple. I know it's not quite that simple, but essentially as a result of that, a couple of commissions were formed by the AICPA to begin to look at standard setting as opposed to a principal's board. And we came up with, as a result of both the Wheat and the Trueblood committees, both a new structure, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, and standard setting, which, you know, is essentially a move away from judgment and a move toward maybe a more civil law versus a common law approach. Now we're 30 years plus later, and we're looking back to saying, well, maybe the standard setting approach isn't the right way. We ought to be doing it a more principles-based approach. The fact is, they're a continuum. They're not. It's like art versus science. You know, you can argue those things, but they're really a continuum. And I think what happens in the 1970s is we create a standards board, and very importantly, the AICPA produces a new ethics rule for its members, Rule 203, which requires those members to follow those standards. That had not existed before. And when you have an ethical requirement that says you must follow the standards of the boards recognized by our governing council, all of a sudden you have tremendous authority behind the standards, not just because the SEC recognizes them, but because it's an ethical violation not to follow them. So I look at that period 30 years ago as opposed to 38, I say 1970, 1974 is a watershed towards standards away from principles.
And I, you know, and that coincides with the establishment of the FASB. And if you, you can hear speakers when they're comparing and contrasting international and FASB standards, they will take the stack of FASB documents that that constitute GAAP and compare them with the international standards. And the initial reaction is, hey, the U.S. accounting standards are overly detailed. What we need to do is move towards a more principles-based standards, such as the international standards, which in terms of volume are far less. Now, of course, the SEC has looked at the issue, and it's kind of hard to argue against having principles-based standards. It's a very interesting thing. When you go back to our archives, the most significant accounting statements from the SEC have been issued in the form of accounting series releases. They are approved by the commission. And when you go back to ASR 12, which was really the adoption of SX, here was a debate. Do you really need rules? Regulation SX just basically provides a structure for the form and content of financial statements. And it has some additional disclosures that are intended not to contradict GAAP, but rather to supplement an FASB statement somewhere to get additional disclosures where it's been deemed to be necessary. Well, back in 1940, when SX was initially adopted, the debate was whether or not you needed any rules whatsoever, or you could rely on the accounting profession to determine what the best presentation for their particular client would be. That was actually a legitimate argument back in 1940. So as the issues have evolved and the various commissions have studied issues and determined that, no, you really need a little bit more form and structure to that, and the FASB has issued a host of accounting standards, you've gotten to the present situation where now people are looking to cut back on the total volume and to get back to a more principles-based approach. The devil, obviously, will be in the detail because companies need the security of having guidelines. They don't want to be second-guessed by the regulators or in court when, in fact, their use of judgment has been questioned. And so it's something that's easier said than done. So it's something that that everyone is working on going forward to try to attain a more principles-based approach.
Jack just referred to ASR 12. I'd be interested in hearing about what some of the other landmark releases have been over the years.
Well, I think you could probably go down each of the chief accountants and find one or two. As we mentioned with Carmen Blau, it would have to be Accounting Series Release 4. But, you know, before he became chief accountant, there's another little interesting story we like to tell about at that time, early in, or in the 30s, it was common practice for an income statement to begin with essentially the net sales figure. That is to say, gross sales and cost of sales would not be provided, and that what the companies would provide would be net sales, and their argument would be that to disclose gross sales and cost of sales would be give up a competitive advantage. One of the things that Carmen had to do in his early service in the SEC, I think before he became chief accountant, was to enforce the requirement of the SEC that no, income statements begin with gross sales less cost of goods sold. I can't imagine living in a world that an income statement began with net sales and cost of goods sold and gross sales were not provided. But those are the kinds of things that evolve over time. Expectations about what's transparency, particularly given the technology of the 21st century and instant global reach, place tremendous expectations upon accountants to interpret complex transactions and simplify them. And I'm saying it all begins with a very modest approach under Blau, and in that particular manner. I would argue that maybe with Accounting Series Release 4 as his banner, you would look at Wernz and say the way in which he was involved in the McKesson-Robbins hearings, which occurred shortly, and that fraud occurred shortly after the formation of the commission, immediately there was doubt about whether or not the accounting profession could deliver on the ability to, you know, provide financial statements that could be relied upon. And by the cooperation between the Office of the Chief Accountant and the leadership and the profession, auditing standards became a factor in that negotiation. And through the way in which the administration of the disposition of McKesson case was decided, again, the private sector, took the lead in establishing auditing standards, although it was, I think, perhaps touch and go during Wernz's chief accountant, which lasted during World War II. I mentioned in Earl King the accounting series release dealing with or his response to Accounting Research Bulletin 32. I think that's the episode. He also was one of the first to be involved in a 2E proceeding against a large firm, Accounting Series Release number 73. That was unusual, but there are times when the commission decided to suspend the ability of a firm to practice in front of the commission. Well, that completely destroys all the timetables for registrations and other activities if your firm is not permitted to practice before the commission. And that was used, in many circumstances to discipline firms when the Office of the Chief Accountant felt, it was inappropriate that they had done something. And here we have, Earl King involved in that in Accounting Series Release 73. Jack, what other ones come to mind?
Like to pick up on the Rule 2E theme, because I think that's a very significant area. That's something that also illustrates the interaction with the Chief Accountant's Office and the Division of Enforcement. And this is an issue that always requires a great deal of serious time and effort on the staff's part, because because the implications are so great for the accountants that are involved in the process. And what you'll see recently is what used to be Rule 2E is now referred to as Rule 102E, and there's suspensions from our standpoint. They apply to practicing before the commission as an accountant. They also apply to lawyers, of course, but that would be more of the general counsel's office's involvement. But what we see these days is that the Rule 102E suspension is not directed solely against the CPA that's working in a major accounting firm or a medium-sized or even a smaller accounting firm, but also where a corporate controller or CFO is involved in fraud or involved in books and records violations, The SEC has taken action under Rule 102E to suspend them, despite the fact they're not CPAs. I think there's a couple of cases that illustrate this quite well. There's a ProQuest matter wherein we suspended a non-CPA who was a controller type. There's the Armstrong determination, which was the basis for the ProQuest matter. In all of these instances, though, the SEC staff spends a great deal of time laboring over the process. We have to go into the legal area. We have a so-called Wells notice, where we would advise the individual and its legal representative of the fact that we're considering making such a recommendation to the commission. That affords them the opportunity to head off the process to raise some arguments as to why we should not take such an action, and as a consequence of that, it's a very seriously considered matter when the commission ultimately takes such an action. We've had occasions where the chief accountant and the division of enforcement have been in different positions on a particular matter, and that has resulted in discussions at closed commission meetings as to the relative merits of the two conflicting positions. But it's been a serious enough issue that the commission has heard the varying arguments and made a determination one way or the other.
Teresa, I think you're onto something here. If we could just spend a little more time in a historical setting and think about contributions and accounting series releases. We haven't talked much about Sandy Burton in his term of service. And of course, peer review accounting series release 173 is often attributed to the instigations that were brought about under that release involving one of the large firms. Not only to mention inflation accounting, which was addressed during the 70s as part of Sandy's term of office, in accounting series release 190 and all the implications that involved. It's difficult to know more recently, say, Bob Herdman and Don Nicolaisen and Con Hewitt, whether, you know, how to measure their impact because it's been so recent, you know, the last 5, 6, 7 years. But in the case of peer review with Sandy and inflation accounting, clearly the whole idea of soft data and a more expansive scope of service were signaled during Sandy's term of service. And that had implications for where the accounting firms went in their own scope of services. And that created issues for people like Mike Sutton and Walter Schutz to have to deal with, particularly when the scope of services issues became concerns over independence. And we talked very little about independence, and yet it's one of the major issues that each of the chief accountants has had to deal with because of the crafting of the term independent public accountant in either the rules or in the legislation. And it's a peculiar circumstance because there's a whole literature around what independence means in the practicing accountant's lexicon. And, you know, it evolves again over time as to what are independent activities when there's 10,000 CPAs versus when there's 300,000 CPAs and the gender balance is about equal and family relationships and career patterns differ. So how you interpret independence, you know, in appearance becomes quite different. I think the independence issue is one that all of the chief accountants have had to address, and some have had more difficult challenges than others, and that's something we haven't spent a lot of time talking about, but clearly there is a history there.
Now, you just mentioned the name of Sandy Burton, Gary. Over the years, I've heard it hinted in some quarters that accountants are, how should I put this, not the most exciting group you've ever met. Present company accepted, of course. I'm sure that's just bad press, but every now and then you'll hear somebody say, oh, but there was Sandy Burton. Can either of you explain to me why he's a standout?
Well, he had a tremendous ability to you know, argue on his feet and not to be unpleasant about it. He could agree without being disagreeable, and I think he had a lot of gusto and a lot of verb, and he was just, kind of a pleasant individual despite the fact you might disagree with him. to somewhat of a lesser extent, but also a very colorful individual was and is Lynn Turner. And I say that with a smile in my voice because he's a very, you know, I mean, you know Lynn, he may be right, he may be wrong, but he's never in doubt. And you just kind of, you know, you kind of grind your teeth when you don't agree with them and you smile when you do. So there are two, at least those two personalities that kind of stand out. But, you know, the real solid nature, the real thoughtful, deep, penetrating thinking of people like Walter Schutz and Mike Sutton certainly belay the image of accountants being dull. These were very active, personable individuals, but they weren't necessarily, you know, prime time characters where they might have their own television show. They weren't Drew Careys of their day. But in some extent, both Lynn and Sandy had that persona that, you know, they had this way of having an audience build into their constituency.
Yeah. I think one of you had started off by asking about John Burton. Now, of course, one of the characteristics of his tenure was he started what we refer to as the Accounting Fellowship Program, which is a very interesting part of the work of the Chief Accountant's Office, because basically it brings people in from the private sector for a two-year period. Most of them have extensive experience with accounting firms. I guess there's been one or two from industry. But it's been mutually beneficial. It's benefited the Chief Accountant's Office by our ability to get fresh looks at things and get perspectives from people who have been out in the field more recently than some of us have, and it's benefited the individuals involved by giving them a sense for how the SEC has operated. So I think that's a testimony to Dr. Burton who started the program over 30 years ago.
I'd like to add some kudos as well to Clarence Sampson, who expanded that program to include academic fellows. You know, we tend to take sometimes the educational feed stream for granted, and without having, individuals who have, and there's been a long and successful generation of academic fellows at the SEC as well. I can think of many of them, such as Mark Taylor and, Ray Stevens and others, Jerry Arnold, Fred Scouse, and many, many more who have served their apprenticeship in regulatory activity at the commission thanks to that program that Sandy started and that Clarence Sampson expanded. We haven't mentioned the two chief accountants that came back-to-back from the University of Maryland, both Clarence, who served a long tour of duty from 76 to 88, and then became a member of the FASB, which is an interesting reversal. Usually you have people coming from the private sector into the commission, but Clarence was a career person in the government, although he had spent some time in public accounting, and was a long-serving chief accountant, perhaps the longest in the last 25, 30 years, followed by Ed Colson, another University of Maryland graduate and someone who had begun his career at the commission. Both of these individuals lived in this transition period of the early 70s and 80s when, standards were becoming the issue. Conceptual framework was a big issue for Clarence. International was a big issue for Ed. And even though Ed served a much shorter term, I think he was pretty well liked and pretty effective for the time he was in the office. And Jack, you served with him, didn't you?
I did, and as you mentioned this, I'm going through my papers, and I came across a very interesting letter from Clarence to Don Kirk, who was the chairman of the FASB at the time, and it's dated July 1985. In that letter, Clarence suggests that Don Kirk, that the board, headed by Don Kirk, study this issue of mark-to-market accounting. Now, does that tell you some issue's been around for a long time, given the congressional interest in mark-to-market accounting this year?
Yes, indeed. And it reminds me of something I had been meaning to ask, which is, do you think that you can describe the history of the Office of the Chief Accountant in terms of cycles? That is, the issues keep coming around, or can you describe it more aptly in terms of swings from public to private and back again? Or is it more like a trend in a specific direction? or all of the above?
I'll take one shot at that. You know, when you look at the appointment process for the commissioners and you think about the role of independent regulatory agencies, which are essentially the fourth branch of government, but they don't really, they're not constitutionally based in that direct way, you do have to read the political will that gets individuals elected into the White House, and then you look for a translation of that political will into the independent agencies that are, responsive to the president who makes those appointments. And of course, Congress is not without its authority because it provides the budget. So I think you do have to understand that independent regulatory agencies are independent in one sense, but their role is to serve the view of the public interest that has been popularly represented in the most recent set of elections and the constitution of both the White House and the Congress. So you do see, I think, shifts in mood, or if you will, attitude, based upon the contemporary issues that are faced in the marketplace.
I don't, based on my experience, I don't really see that dramatic a difference. When you have a Democratic administration, possibly you'll have a more hands-on approach and perhaps a few more rules, whereas a Republican administration, you're likely to have more of a laissez-faire attitude to business. But I think the differences are very subtle, and I think if you track each of the eight accounts, chief accounts I've served under, I think you'd really have difficulty assessing a political influence in the work product.
The one point that does come up there, Jack, and I don't think I disagree with you. When I had a conversation with Mike Sutton, he's now retired and lives in Williamsburg. He commented upon how impressed he was coming in from the practice community to the dedication of the staff, and I think he put it in very colorful terms. He said essentially to salute the flag every day. There's a commitment to the public interest in the staff levels that I think assures that the sway doesn't go too far.
Well, we've got just a minute to summarize, and I guess I'll ask you, Gary, if you could, in 25 words or less, tell us how financial accounting today is different than it was in 1935, the year the first chief accountant took office.
Well, I think we've certainly created a body of knowledge around financial reporting and disclosure, and we have now a profession of, probably closer to 500,000 in public companies that didn't exist at that time. The size of the economy is such that if we hadn't had the commission and the profession working together, I'm not sure that the capital markets would have been well served.
And Jack, 25 words or less on the changes that you've seen in your tenure with the commission.
Well, we have a globalization aspect that probably wasn't even envisioned back in 1935 when you have so many more multi-dimensional companies that are serving the securities markets both here and abroad.
Jack and Gary, thank you for sharing your thoughts on the SEC Office of the Chief Accountant, the guardian of the financial markets to some. Today's program is now added to the growing number of materials on accounting already in the museum collections, particularly the 1940 McKesson and Robbins report that was referred to earlier, previous fireside chats on forensic accounting in September 2004, and accounting aspects of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in September 2007. The 2007 annual meeting program on Who's Counting, the critical role of financial reporting in the capital markets, and interviews with former SEC chief accountants Andrew Barr, Carmen Blau, John C. or Sandy Burton, Edmund Colson, A. Clarence Sampson, Walter Schutz, Michael Sutton, and Lynn Turner. Today's fireside chat can be accessed again on demand in the online program section of the museum, in both MP3 and transcript format. Next month's Fireside Chat will look at the SEC Office of the Chairman. Our panelists will be Leonard Lyman, who worked with SEC Chairman Manuel Cohen in the 1960s, and Peter Derby, who worked with SEC Chairman William Donaldson earlier this decade. The chat will be broadcast on Tuesday, May 12th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. It will be free and accessible worldwide without prior registration. please plan to join us again on www.sechistorical.org. Thank you for being with us today.